Our scripture text for this week is Numbers chapter 6. As you're turning there, realize we are still in the preparation stage of massing the troops and getting everyone's mindset wrapped around what it's going to take to dwell with this God who, if he does not accompany them, they will never be able to take the promised land. So they are taking censuses, counting the troops, getting them ready, but also they are being given serious, careful precautions that God is giving them, saying, if you want to dwell with me, you must take all of my instructions seriously. And we've noted each week that one of the things God keeps highlighting, and it'll be a highlight throughout this whole book of Numbers, is you must be pure if you expect God to dwell with you. You must be free of anything that would spiritually contaminate. And there are lots of physical things given to them to represent that. Physical ways they need to be pure to represent the purity they need to approach God. We're going to take a special look at some of this kind of purity this week in Numbers chapter 6 with the Nazirite vow. It's a way to demonstrate complete and pure devotion to God. It's not required of the people, but it's a way for the rest of the people to take note, seeing those that might go ahead and voluntarily take this time of special and pure devotion to God and have the whole nation realize that is what we're all actually called to, not to actually be Nazirites, not to actually keep these specific vows, but to have that kind of all-consuming devotion to the Lord. And that's what it's going to require for us to dwell with him and him to dwell with us. With that in mind, hear now the word of the Lord. Numbers chapter 6, verse 1. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when either a man or a woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazirite, to separate himself to the Lord, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar made from wine or strong drink, and shall not drink any juice of grapes or eat grapes, fresh or dried. All the days of his separation, he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine, not even the seeds or the skins. All the days of his vow of separation, no razor shall touch his head until the time is completed for which he separates himself to the Lord. He shall be holy. He shall let the locks of hair of his head grow long. All the days that he separates himself to the Lord, he shall not go near a dead body, not even for his father or for his mother, for brother or sister. If they die, shall he make himself unclean, because his separation to God is on his head. All the days of his separation, he is holy to the Lord. And if any man dies very suddenly beside him, and he defiles his consecrated head, then he shall shave his head on the day of his cleansing. On the seventh day, he shall shave it. On the eighth day, he shall bring two turtle doves or two pigeons to the priest to the entrance of the tent of meeting, and the priest shall offer one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering, and make atonement for him because he sinned by reason of the dead body, and he shall consecrate his head that same day and separate himself to the Lord for the days of his separation, and bring a male lamb a year old for a guilt offering. But the previous period shall be void, because his separation was defiled. And this is the law for the Nazirite. When the time of his separation has been completed, he shall be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting, and he shall bring his gift to the Lord, one male lamb a year old without blemish for a burnt offering, and one ewe lamb a year old without blemish as a sin offering, and one ram without blemish as a peace offering, and a basket of unleavened bread, loaves of fine flour mixed with oil, and unleavened wafers smeared with oil, and their grain offerings and their drink offerings. And the priest shall bring them before the Lord and offer his sin offering and his burnt offering. And he shall offer the ram as a sacrifice of peace offering to the Lord with the basket of unleavened bread. The priest shall offer also its grain offering and its drink offering. And the Nazirite shall shave his consecrated head at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and shall take the hair from his consecrated head and put it on the fire that is under the sacrifice of the peace offering. And the priest shall take the shoulder of the ram when it is boiled, and one unleavened loaf out of the basket, and one unleavened wafer, and shall put them on the hands of the Nazirite after he has shaved the hair of his consecration. And the priest shall wave them for a wave offering before the Lord. They are a holy portion for the priest, together with the breast that is waved and the thigh that is contributed. And after that, the Nazarite may drink wine. This is the law of the Nazarite. But if he vows an offering to the Lord above his Nazarite vow, as he can afford, in exact accordance with the law that he takes, then he shall do in addition to the law of the Nazarite. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, Thus you shall bless the people of Israel. You shall say to them, The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. So shall they put my name upon the people of Israel, and I will bless them. The word of the Lord. Okay, kids, we don't have as many of you here this week, but we have you here, and I'm very glad we have our children here too. So, do you guys ever get in trouble for messing up some clothes you were supposed to keep nice? Does that ever happen? Maybe a nice white shirt you had on, and you were getting ready to maybe go to church or go somewhere fancy, and your parents said, now, don't mess that up. And you spill grape juice on it, maybe, or chocolate. Do your parents like it when that happens? Nope, right? Because sometimes that shirt's ruined. Is that what they say? Ah, you ruined it. What if you had a nice white shirt on and you were told, keep that clean, we're going to a wedding. It has to look nice. You said, okay. And then you went and snuck a Hershey's Kiss. You started chewing it. And you loved it so much you were chewing sloppy and all of a sudden a big thing of chocolate comes out and right on your shirt. What are your parents going to say? What did I tell you? I told you to keep it clean. What if you said, it's only one stain? It might be only one stain, but is that a clean shirt anymore? Nope, big blob of chocolate. What we see in our verses today is that God has to ask us to be perfectly holy. That means no sin at all. And even if we only did one sin, that's like that shirt. It might only be one stain, but it's not clean anymore, is it? Even one sin would have God have to say, well, then you can't come to heaven. Because sin keeps you out, and I have to punish sin. That's why it's so wonderful that Jesus never, ever sinned. He had a perfectly clean life, like a clean shirt. He didn't have one sin. And that means if he gives that to you, then God can let you into heaven and love you just like you never, ever sinned. Because Jesus was perfect for you. We need that, don't we? Because do we all sin? Yep. And so we should thank God that just for trusting in him, that's all we have to do. He'll say, I'll give you my clean life forever. And you can be in heaven with me and we'll love you forever. Can you think about that during the sermon? And how nice it is that Jesus did that for us? Okay, thank you for listening. So, as we have talked, we're zeroing in on the kind of pure devotion that God is requiring of his people. And he is using this idea of the Nazarite to show to them, here's the kind of devotion I want from you all. And so we're going to look at three things here in this sermon. First, the kind of complete devotion God requires of us, and that it has to go beyond mere good intentions. God's holiness is real, and his standards are real. And so our intentions can be fine, but that doesn't cut it. God demands actual, true holiness. I'm going to look at the fact that part of being devoted to God means a sincere recognition of our sin. Not just acknowledging that we're sinful, but its severity. Meaning we have to acknowledge that we truly deserve death if we are going to devote ourselves to God. And then third, we're going to look at the fact that if we did not have God's promises that he is going to come to us and keep us as his people, then we would have no hope of our devotion ever being received by him. We have to trust in his promises because our devotion will not accomplish it on its own. So beginning here, let's look at the kind of devotion God is requiring of Israel. The Nazarite vow is an interesting thing, and it's, again, not something required of all the people. In many ways, that makes it the most interesting. There usually aren't many optional things that God throws out to his people. It's this or death, often, particularly when he deals with Israel. But here, there's this option given to those who want to take this up. And I think that's adding to the beauty of it. People will see, wow, they didn't have to do this, but wow, what a beautiful thing true, pure devotion to Yahweh is. And so we take a look at some of the requirements. First, they cannot have contact with the dead. And that's a pretty obvious one. I mean, even just in a physical manner, touching something dead usually is an instant example of uncleanness and defilement. That idea is very in our faces today. But you see, these requirements were, I don't want to say extreme, that makes it sound unfair, but they were very, I'll throw it out there, they were extreme. Not only could you not touch a dead body, but this also meant, you said, not even for your mother or your father, your sister or brother. This means you cannot go into the typical kind of mourning situation into the presence of a dead body. If it's your own mother or father has died, you cannot go in and mourn. It's very significant. But then there was a scenario, and I don't know why I find these comical sometimes, the scenarios often that the biblical law shows up, and in case this happens, in case that happens. And so if you're standing there and some dude just drops dead next to you, boom, you technically didn't do anything wrong. Maybe you should have looked. I mean, if you're a Nazarene, maybe you should just stay away from anybody who looks like they might be going any minute. But but did you see all the offerings you have to offer? You have to offer sin and guilt offerings yourself because of accidental contact with a dead body. And then, even if you had vowed a 40-day Nazarite period and you were on day 39 and someone dropped dead next to you, you have to go offer these sin and guilt offerings for that contact, and 39 days are void. You got to start over. This is what I mean by God illustrating the things like good intentions aren't enough. He's saying, I have to have an unyielding standard of perfection. And so in many ways, arbitrary is the wrong word here. But there's nothing technical. There's nothing sinful about someone dying next to you and falling on you, right? You didn't do anything wrong. So God is pulling something here, just saying, look, I'm just going to illustrate the fact that I have a standard. I'm just going to put it out there, and I must keep it. I must keep to it. I can't relent on it, okay? As a symbol of the fact that my holiness cannot be lessened, and I, as a holy God, am not able. It's not just he's not willing. God's not able to tone down his standards. And so good intentions, better than we used to be, better than our neighbor, aren't enough. Then we have this idea of avoiding eating or drinking alcohol or any grape-related thing. I love those. Not seeds, not raisins, not even, I don't know who's out there popping grape skins, but if that was your thing, you can't do it while you're a Nazarite, okay? People have speculated on the reason for this, and I think what makes the most sense, where several scholars have gone, is the fact that since wine is a symbol of joy throughout the Bible, and grapes are related to it, this idea of there are times when being devoted to the Lord means you give up things that are enjoyable. You give up things that are good. You voluntarily forego certain things that you would love to experience, but the service called upon you means you forego them, and you count it joy. Again, true devotion to the Lord brings us into contact with that kind of sacrifice all the time. Not grapes, grape skins, and wine necessarily, but the idea of, wow, I would love to do X, Y, and Z, but the needs around me that are calling me to give to them mean I have to forego that. Whether it's time that is precious, I think that's probably one of the chief ones for many of us, or whether it is financial things, we would love to spend money on X, Y, or Z, but we see clearly that so-and-so's needs demand I forego that earthly thing that would be fun to spend that money on because clearly this is more important, that their needs are met. And for many of us parents, it's sleep. Whatever it is that's often called, you are called upon to sacrifice as it's a good thing for the service of God by serving others, we see here with the Nazarite vow, that's a beautiful thing. and often is expected of those who are going to devote themselves to Yahweh. And there's also this, an idea here, both with the mourning of the dead, as well as the forbiddance of drinking wine, and as well now as we get to the no cutting of hair. There's a real parallel here with the way God set apart the high priests. Now, the high priests were not given this complete avoidance of all things grape-related, but while they were serving in the tent, they were not permitted to ever drink any wine. They were also not permitted to mourn in some of the same ways that the Nazarites were forbidden to go near dead bodies. Now, the priests were not told they couldn't cut their hair, but the reason the haircut is going on here is not because God naturally thinks that uncut and unkempt hair is holy, but it's a symbol of their devotion to him. It's a way, one, that can be physically set apart, but two, in many ways, scholars think this is a picture of, oddly as it may seem to you, life, this growing symbol of life. And again, if in many ways the opposite of the idea of no contact with dead. Let's go to the opposite extreme. And, excuse me, I'm on the wrong spot here. The way that their head is called holy to the Lord while they're in this time of their Nazarite vow is the same wording that is on the crown of the priest, the high priest. Those words, holy to the Lord, are written there. So it's a symbol then of their devotion to God and his acceptance of that. And so in many ways, these Nazarites are being elevated to the height, almost, of the kind of holiness the high priests were given by God. And again, why would this be? If the Nazarites are a reminder to the whole people of the kind of beautiful devotion they should all be offering to God, then this is a reminder, too, in the fact that he called them all to be a kingdom of priests. You should all be, in many ways, those who are calling the nations around you to see that Yahweh is the true God. And so you could take this vow at your own desire. You could make it for as long or as little as you wanted. It seems as though if God wanted there to be long hair growing, this is probably not something he did for a few days, but for a significant amount of time. We have a few Nazarites specifically mentioned in Scripture. Samson, as set apart by God to be a Nazarite. We have Samuel being one as well. We have a few people in the time of Amos being set apart as Nazarites. We don't hear of them very often. Given the way that Israel lived in the land, probably safe to say it wasn't something that many people took up. Devoting themselves to Yahweh didn't seem to be a very high value for the people of Israel throughout most of their existence in the Promised Land. But nevertheless, we do see that this is a picture that was supposed to be a beautiful one, not one that was like, ugh, man, no wine, no haircuts. Oh, sheesh. No, it was supposed to be. And I think because of the height God gave to it, the praise he gave to it, one that would have preached to the people saying, yes, devotion to the Lord is an honorable and powerful thing. And many probably thought it was beyond them. So, summing up this first point, God is reminding any who would say, I want to dwell with Yahweh, and I want Yahweh to dwell with me, he would say, then you must take my holiness seriously. I am unable to water it down to suit what you would like. I'm unable to cater it to how you would like to live. If you want to dwell with me, you must approach me on my terms and my terms only. So the next point I was mentioning was the fact that devotion to God also involves a sincere acknowledgement of both the existence of our sin, but also the fact that it deserves death. And I don't know if you picked up on this when we were reading through the requirements for the Nazarite vow, but when the time of your vow was over, when you had completed it, you notice a significant amount of sacrifice was required for you to kind of exit this process. In fact, the kinds of offerings demanded here were absolutely the sin offering or peace offering. However, it cost you more than the usual ones did. And I think for the reason of this, you were elevated to a higher standard. You were living, quote unquote, closer to Yahweh than you normally were outside the Nazarite context. That means you're exposed to more of Yahweh's holiness. That means more of your own sin would have been revealed. Therefore, you're offering something, acknowledging, costing you more, acknowledging the depth of your sin more than your fellow countrymen. And this has caused a quandary for some, saying, wait a minute. Particularly a Jewish scholar who was excellent, saying, but if he hadn't done anything wrong during this time, if he hadn't broken his Nazarite vow, what's all this offering for? And it comes down to this. It's in our hearts. Obviously. Yes, he might not have broken the details of the Nazarite vow, but there's no way anyone undergoing that vow or anyone in our situation today can ever devote ourselves so wholly to God, so perfectly to him, that one, it would be free of imperfection for him to say, wow, you know, you have actually put me in your debt. I actually owe you a pay raise. You have done so well. Not only can we never get that far, but we also can't ever do so well that our good deeds somehow pay for things we've done before. If anything, the closer we get to God in the sense of understanding who he is, the more we understand his holiness, it doesn't mean we sin more, but we certainly become more aware of how atrocious our sin actually is. And I think we would do well to go to the words of Christ in Luke 17 when he says this, "Will any one of you who has a servant plowing or keeping sheep say to him when he has come in from the field, 'Come at once and recline at table'? Will you not rather say to him, 'Prepare supper for me and dress properly and serve me while I eat and drink, and afterward you will eat and drink?' Does he thank the servant because he did what he was commanded? So you also, when you have done all that you were commanded, say, 'We are unworthy servants. We have only done what was our duty.' I know for a fact in my own soul, I suspect perhaps in yours, there are times when we think God owes us better than what we've done because we think we have earned it. We deserve a better lot in life, a better amount of respect from others, whatever it is, because we have lived lives holier than others, and how can I not be recognized for that? But Christ says, what? You aren't thanked for doing your duty. That's what you're supposed to do, right? You're thanked when you go over and above. None of us can do that. So also the Nazarite, though he may have been so wonderfully devoted to the Lord, cannot exit without offering up an acknowledgement that his sin before the Lord, not even a breaking of the Nazarite vow, but the sin that is in his soul, still demands an acknowledgement to God that, yes, I recognize I deserve this. Thank you for allowing substitutes in my place. And so I think all of us could do well to examine how well we acknowledge our own sin. First of all, I think we struggle to even admit our sin, let alone then properly deal with it. How often when you are confronted with your own sin, is your knee-jerk reaction a counterattack? When someone, particularly in a relationship with us perhaps, suggests that you have done something wrong, do you first soul search and see, is there something to this? Or right away, do you go to the things you've been keeping track of anyway to say, oh yeah? Well, how about how you did this? Or you're a hypocrite, you do this too. Let's say it's true. Let's say they are a hypocrite and they do this too. Does that somehow mean you don't? Does that mean, oh, well, since they do this, then it means I'm okay? I think often if counterattack is not what we do when our sin is exposed to us, we just rationalize it. If someone confronts us perhaps or makes us aware that we do this, right away, you know what? It's a rough week. How can they expect better from me? And by the way, it wasn't technically wrong because I, you know, this, and that. Well, however, we are experts at that. I know we are all experts at rationalizing away our sin. So it's very hard to acknowledge the severity of our sin if we don't even admit to it. So absolutely, we have to start by owning, yes, I do these things. I'm not saying that you're sinning if You don't own every accusation that comes your way. You do receive false accusations in life, okay? Don't hear me saying you have to be a doormat, and if you ever try to defend yourself against a wrong attack that you're somehow sinning. I'm just betting that we probably call things false accusations a lot more often than they actually are. So if we at least begin by acknowledging our sin, I think somehow we then fail to repent well. And so I think often we might see, yes, I totally did that. But instead of doing the right thing by saying, I am sorry, will you forgive me? And really seeking to turn around the other way to change our behavior, I think often we'll try to substitute that with maybe kind actions. It'll kill us to have to say the words, but I'll do something nice for them. And work a little bit harder, and maybe I can just not have to own what I did. But at least that way, I'm kind of showing them that, you know, I kind of feel sorry. Or maybe you're just one of those, if I just ignore this, hopefully it'll just go away. Maybe I'll never have to mention it, and they will just get over it, and I can not have to openly admit it, and then do the painful thing of seeking forgiveness. These are just ways of trusting in our works, finding our identity in our behavior. If we have a real solid hope in Christ, we don't have to find our identity in our behavior or other people's view of us. And I think often we have this fear, if I admit to my sin, then I'm worthless. Well, again, we don't realize so often that we're the that everybody else sees it, right, in those situations. So often, like, oh, man, I got to keep this hidden. Like, it's the elephant in the room, man. Like, everyone sees what you did. And you're only making it way worse by refusing to admit it. But also I think we think, if I admit to this, though, then I lose my credibility. I lose my status. I lose my reputation that I want. So I can't admit it. Not realizing we are destroying, we are taking a hammer, a sledgehammer to our credibility by sitting there and refusing to own our sin. I don't know about you, but in my experience, some moments where my respect for people has gone through the roof and where I have been immensely humbled is when I've seen people really, honestly own their sin and ask forgiveness. You don't do it for that reason, okay? Ooh, I get some status if I, please, because our sin will find ways to do that too. But realize it's a lie often. Now, might it be true? Might it be true that someone, after you acknowledging their sin, might turn away from you, might lose respect for you? Yeah. It's the right thing to do anyway. Might be part of the consequences of our sin, that they sin in response to our forgiveness. But it still doesn't change the fact that that's the right thing to do. And that's hard for us to acknowledge how severe our sin is, that it is ugly, and that, yes, even as redeemed people, it deserves death. No matter how well we've devoted ourselves to God, we have to continue to acknowledge that because it's what he's called us to. And we see that here in the Nazarite vow. And so, with God's bar set very high with how much we should devote ourselves to him and how, what's the word I'm looking for? The kind of sobriety that we should have in truly owning our sin. I think that if we did not have his promises given to us, that he will be our God no matter what, we would absolutely lose hope. And so we turn to the third part here. If we must be hoping in his promises that he's going to keep us and bless us, to have any hope in gaining progress in both devoting ourselves, finding his standard beautiful, and owning our sin. And so we have this beautiful, I wish I could call Greg up here real quick to preach this portion. We have a very beautiful, beautiful Hebrew poem here, and he could explain to you in far more skill than I could why it is so beautiful. But it comes at a really apropos time, and it's situated here in an interesting place in the book of Numbers. But as God is mustering his people to send them forth, they need a reminder that he is going to be their God, and he's going to keep them and bless them. And so I think we too should look well at what he's seeing. He calls, he sets the standard high for them. and then says, but here is the God I'm going to be for you. So Gordon Wenham, a wonderful Old Testament scholar, this might sound technical to you guys, but it kind of needs to be technical. Because what God is doing here is not just an artful piece of poetry, but I think what God has done here is construct something lyrically that is as beautiful as the content. And so because that would jump off the page to them, I want to see how interestingly constructed this is. And so this will probably be overly technical, and that's kind of the point, if that makes sense. So here's Gordon Wenham. The first line of the poem consists of three words in Hebrew with a total of 12 syllables. The second line, 5 words and 14 syllables. The third, 7 words and 16 syllables. Even the number of Hebrew consonants builds up steadily, 15, 20, 25. If one subtracts God's name mentioned 3 times, then there are 12 words left, no doubt symbolizing the 12 tribes of Israel. Grammatically, there's no need to repeat God's name, but the repetition emphasizes that the Lord is the source of all Israel's benefits, as does the last clause, I will bless them, and the I is emphatic. So it's a very powerfully constructed poem here, but because the content is all the more powerful. So I'll read it to you again here. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, thus you shall bless the people of Israel. You shall say to them, here's where it begins, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. So as many have surmised, they think that though this would not have been clear to them back at the time, the threefold mention of the Lord, of Yahweh, is not only emphatic, but it's also, again, should rightly through the Father and the Son and the Spirit being the ones blessing them here. So this benediction is a promise that can give us hope. So it begins by the Lord bless you. And we've heard this so many times, right? It could easily roll off our backs. Like, yeah, that's the thing they say at the end of the service, right? I think we don't know how to receive benedictions often. Now, here at Trinity, we've only ever given you actual benedictions, but I know a lot of places give you what are called doxologies that are substituted as benedictions. But if you're ever at a service somewhere and it starts off, and now to him, then you just missed out, okay? It's right for us to sing doxologies and glorify God, but that's sent heavenward, now to him, okay? But this is the Lord blessing you. That's why we don't command it here at Trinity, but I love the posture many of us take of holding our arms out because that's what you're doing. You're receiving something. That's why I end each week when I say, God has one more word of encouragement for you as he sends you out to be ambassadors of these things. So they are receiving this, something they cling to. And it starts with the Lord bless you. Well, one of the things that we can, again, of course, blessing. It's one of the most common words we would use. And often when the Old Testament talks about God blessing, it's very often good temporal things that they could experience, whether it's many children or property or prosperity. And that would be included in the kinds of blessings God is offering to his people, but none more important than his presence with them. That's what they need more than anything. And so that is the chief blessing they would receive. So the Lord bless you and the Lord keep you. And this is not just I'm keeping you around, but I'm guarding you, I'm protecting you. But it has an idea of being his. That's who the Lord protects, those who are his own. So there's a good way of looking at this. When the people were given the option in the book of Joshua to follow the Lord or not, they use the same word with the idea of being preserved by God. So here's Joshua 24:16. Far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods, for it is the Lord our God who brought us and our fathers up from the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, and who did those great signs in our sight and preserved us in all the way that we went and among all the peoples through whom we passed. So whether they were referencing this promise or not, that's the idea of what God is promising them. I will guard you, keep you, and protect you. And then it says, may the Lord make his face shine upon you. In many ways, this is almost like, may God smile at you. May God have a favorable expression on his face when he looks at you. And obviously, God doesn't have an actual face. The idea is, may God look favorably upon you. And as a result, if God is looking favorably at you, then he's being gracious to you. The next part, of the promise. And then he says, may he lift up his countenance on you. I don't know why every translation except for one, for the most part, uses countenance, when that is a word that's kind of just gone. I think a helpful way to understand this is, may he turn his face toward you. The idea of this, may he look at you and pay attention to you. One scholar even said, may he show you favoritism. And I think that's what's being wrapped up in this. May God not just have a favorable expression in his face, but may that face be paying attention to you and doing all these things that are already talked about, showing you favoritism. Because why? You're his own. And all of these things commented in what? May he turn his face toward you and give you peace. Again, this word shalom is used in all sorts of ways, particularly in our day, many ways that are not scriptural. But this is not so much rest from war, as we've talked about before. It's a state of well-being, predominantly because what? You are convinced Yahweh is for you. Yahweh is your God, and he is giving you all that you need. Therefore, you can be free of fear, free of anxiety. You can rest in his care. But if God demands the kind of devotion we see here and demands acknowledgement of our sin the way that he demands, and we know we don't devote ourselves the way that we should, and we certainly don't acknowledge our sin the way he's called us to, how can we expect to receive blessings like this? We certainly have not earned them. We certainly can't claim a right to them based on our devotion. And so that's why I think verse 27 is so important. We see God instruct them. So they, meaning the priests, shall put my name upon the people of Israel, and I will bless them. So God is sanctioning, licensing the priests to use his name, to invoke it, and put it on the people. But he's saying, I will be the one. The priests may say these words all they want, but I'm the one blessing them. I'm commissioning the priests to use this as my means of blessing these people. And as noted before, and I will bless them is a very emphatic statement there. I mean, this is going to happen. All these things I promise you are going to happen. But the question is how? Again, the only way is because he would cover them with his name. He would make them his own, adopt them as his own. And obviously that is our only hope as well. As we've mentioned often here at Trinity, it's that picture of the prodigal son returning home. He's not simply welcomed by the father. He's not simply given clean clothes by the father to cover up his filthy rags. He is given the father's robe, which would have had the family pattern woven into it. It's a statement of, though you disowned me, though you cut yourself off from me, I'm not simply welcoming you home. I am adopting you again. I am making you my son, covering you with my name. That's your only chance. And the reason we can have hope in this is because Jesus, in many ways, was the ultimate Nazarite and the ultimate sin offering that all of us have to offer the Lord for our sin. Matthew 2:23, is an interesting verse mentioning that he's going to dwell in the town of Nazareth. It says, this was done so that what was spoken by the prophets might be fulfilled. He shall be called a Nazarene. Well, that verse is nowhere in the Old Testament. Okay, there's nowhere in the prophets that say he's going to dwell in Nazareth. And many think that what Matthew's doing by saying it was across the prophets, not meaning one specific prophet, is he's saying there's a general theme in the prophets about this. And the root for Nazarite is similar to two other words, the branch of Jesse, as well as one set apart to the Lord. We know both are true of Christ. And so that Matthew's inviting the wordplay there, saying, yes, this is the branch that was set apart. That's what's been foretold. And that's what we need. Someone who is so devoted to the Lord that it is perfect. So devoted, in fact, he doesn't need to offer a sin offering for what dwells in his heart because he is perfect. I think we see that idea mentioned so powerfully for us in Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 5. We'll begin. Listen to Christ devoting himself to the Lord as our high priest. Consequently, when Christ came into the world, he said, sacrifices and offerings you have not desired, but a body you have prepared for me. In burnt offerings and sin offerings you have taken no pleasure. Then I said, behold, I have come to do your will, O God, as it is written of me in the scroll of the book. And by that will we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. Every priest stands daily at his service, offering repeatedly the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But when Christ had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from that time until his enemies should be made a footstool for his feet. For by a single offering, he has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified. So we see there in one section, both Christ devoted to do the will of the Father and then being that offering for us. You see what Christ is saying, what the Lord is saying here is, do you think I wanted lots of sacrifices? Do you think I delighted in animals being slaughtered? What I wanted was one person to finally come and do my will, finally devote themselves to me perfectly, and none of you have done it. And these bulls and goats couldn't pay for your sin, but they reminded you that someone had better do it. And so I sent my son. He says, fine, I'll do it. Behold, I have come to do your will. You didn't want sacrifices. You wanted obedience. That's what I've done with perfect devotion, but I'm doing it for them so they can have hope, so they can approach my throne knowing they won't be turned away, so they can be those that have reason to continue to devote themselves because they won't be turned away, so they can be those that continue to own their sin because they know that I won't ever tire of forgiving them. So they can be honest about it, knowing that I have paid for it once and for all. Why should they hide their sin? They can be those who forgive and repent because they have this hope. The ultimate Nazarite has been pure and devoted in their place and has been their sin offering for them.